Good morning. Big issues with small changes are on our agenda today. Neil Conan considers the implications of the Wisconsin primary, the war games on the edge of the South China Sea, and the first group of refugees sent back from Greece to Turkey. Meanwhile, your wallet is on the mind of a guy who says many of us who've lost our financial common sense can reactivate it with a little help. ShopSmart used Avery Tosaka has some tips. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Director Moses Goods and his Windward Community College theater students make the legends of the Windward Side come alive with tales of Ko'olaupoku. And Kauai's women in theater are now a nomadic troupe, but that hasn't slowed them down. Their new show is Wit Happens.
It's Tuesday, April 5th. Stay here for the conversation right after the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Taking a look at what it costs to live here, yeah?
Well, yeah, and maybe with some variables that we don't all like to talk about a whole bunch, but we're going to talk about that this morning. Now, a week ago, you probably saw the front page illustration on the Star Advertiser. 48% of state residents polled said that they live paycheck to paycheck. That's according to a report from the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. And in many cases, that includes people who have good jobs, but perhaps some who don't have so good spending habits. And that has David Tosaka concerned. He says that frugality is no longer a badge of shame, but a sign of wisdom. He teaches individuals and companies the small habit changes he first learned when he started his saving money journey back in 1972 and had to live on $300 a month for expenses. David Tosaka joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
You are one of those enviable people who had a natural talent developed out of necessity and then has been able to make a business at it. How did that first happen when you talked to a friend's company who then asked you to help them out because they weren't able to cut expenses?
Well, it's really hot topic now. And back when I worked with his company in San Francisco, they were about $500 million, and he wondered why I always could get better deals than any of his employees for their particular purchases. And I told him that it was because I was passionate about saving money his employees weren't.
That was back in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. And since then you've been able to help a lot of individuals and a lot of companies understand that you have to be passionate about saving the money. It's not just a matter of getting the job done. How well does that resonate with people in a culture where it's get it done fast, get it done as well as you can, and move on?
Well, it may resonate for some, but for many, what they have is they don't have the time nor the inclination. So when I work with clients, they can either learn the system themselves or they can hire me to do their purchases for them.
Right. And we don't mean this to be a commercial for you in any sort of way, but the sense that all of us can reevaluate how we do what we do. You say we've got to invest a little bit more time in that. When time is so critical and we are so time challenged in many ways, you talk about the small things that happen every single day that have far more impact than, say, what I might save if I'm buying a car.
Right. And what the primary objective is never to pay retail. And a lot of people said that's impossible. But working in this field for many decades, it's always possible. It's just that you have to know how.
So how do we avoid falling into that, I got to have it now, and it's there, this is the price, I'm going to pay it because I want it?
Well, that's what I call I win. I want it now. And it's the classic economic principle of sacrificing present consumption for future well-being. And unfortunately, a lot of people have not learned that process.
That sounds like more of the ethos of, say, the Greatest Generation or maybe early boomers, but not necessarily something that's been transmitted in successive generations. When did we lose our common sense?
I think it came out when the boomers became parents and they were maybe dual working parents, so they weren't at home. And a lot of what I would call money wisdom was not taught to their kids.
So what should have been taught?
I would say, number one, to have a budget each month, to know the big thing that we push with my foundation is that to buy a home. Buying a home is probably the biggest choice a person can make to stabilize their financial life. But we have one of the lowest home ownership percentages in the country right here in Hawaii.
But you know why? Because they're so expensive.
They are, but there are programs available that can solve this home ownership problems, but many people don't take advantage of them.
What type of programs?
There are federal grants that are administered by the city to do this. There are organizations like the Hawaii Home Ownership Center, which actually takes a person step by step toward home ownership. And the big thing is that this one step alone would stabilize a person's financial life in the long run.
Now, there are a lot of people in Hawaii for whom that is just not possible. They don't have enough down payment. They are going to be saving a lot of money over a long period of time to be able to do that, even with some of these programs. But they could benefit from some of the smaller changes that you say happen when we are doing impulse buying. And we know the whole business about going through the checkout line and saying, oh, maybe this is good, and throwing that in, and there's another couple dollars wasted.
Right. And what happens is that people who don't know the system are very vulnerable to the marketing strategies.
And we should say that you have a marketing degree, and that's in part
why
you've been doing this.
But most of my things have been learned in real life, my own experiences. And simple strategies is the key. But simple strategies done on an ongoing basis, not just a one-time shot deal that I saved $10 on something. It's a compounded savings that make a difference in a person's life.
And doing it consistently is what I hear you say.
Right.
So what do you mean by saying, knowing the system? What system do we need to know so that we don't find ourselves so vulnerable?
One of the biggest traps is what I call the low monthly payment trap, which used to be for cars, where you have low monthly payments for a $30,000 car. But now it's trickled down into technology, such as smartphones. There are some smartphones that approach $1,000 in price, and a lot of people don't have that. So now carriers will bundle in the payments into your monthly payments.
There used to be a phrase about, beware the bundle, because it comes with all kinds of traps. You're saying that that's still very true.
Very true. And the lack of education causes people to falter again, again, and again. And what that produces is high debt, no savings, no safety net, and no future security for their financial life.
Because they're only looking at their monthly outlay as opposed to what it's going to cost them over time.
Right.
But for a lot of people who are caught in that situation where they only have X number of dollars a month, and they're trying to do a number of things, what seems to be implicit in what you're saying is you better reevaluate what it is you think you really need.
Right. And what happens is that the sad situation, many of the most vulnerable are the most resistant to change. And what that produces is they become a financial fatality.
So who's most vulnerable?
I would say the people who are living in that instant gratification mindset. I'm going to lease a $30,000 car. I'm going to rent a luxury home or condo, which takes over 50% of my take-home pay. One of the goals that I set is to save 25% or more on everything you buy. And that equates to, say you're in a 15% tax bracket, that equates to a 40% saving when you apply it to pre-tax dollars.
So give me a couple of things that people could take away and start to do tomorrow that would make a difference if they were consistent.
Evaluate their needs versus wants. Reevaluate and assess their cell phone plans. Reevaluate their cable or TV bills, look at their technology and see why they're buying what they buy, and look at options. Never pay retail for anything, and always think before you buy.
And what about that term sale? Because very often we've heard about people who spave. They spend to save.
Right. It's part of the same system. You have to know if it's a need or a want. Many people just want things. They don't need a new phone, but they want it because they want to be in the in crowd. The biggest trap is this marketing-driven system where you have to be cool, you need something, whatever that something is.
Whereas your phone that you may have had that might be a year or two old is perfectly serviceable.
It's perfectly fine.
All right. Well, thank you very much. You've given us some stuff to think about, whether it's going to be difficult or not to do. May very well depend on how we look at that stuff. But thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
David Tasaka teaches saving money seminars called Shop Smart You, and is the executive director of the Light Foundation, whose mission is to empower lives through education. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:16. Coming up, the legends of Windward Oahu and the Palaku Theater stage, but first a trip to the not-so-frugal backyard.
In today's backyard quiz, we go back to the high-flying 80s when conspicuous consumption was the norm for Hawaii's nouveau riche. The weekly polo matches on Oahu were a gathering place for the fancy car set, and nobody drove fancier cars than the man whose name we're looking for this morning. Each week, he would show up at Mokulea with a different Rolls-Royce or an Excalibur, and the polo set was deeply impressed, even more so when he described himself as a former NFL player. When he revealed that he had an investment company, one whose corporate name included those of distinguished Kama'aina families, his new friends couldn't wait to sign up. The promise of a 25% quarterly return didn't hurt either. Well, you guessed it. He was a swindler, and his company was a classic Ponzi scheme. He was eventually caught, exposed, and sent to prison, but not before he got a chance to live high on the hog for a while. So, who was this man? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get the HPR T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Gil Riviere. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Every part of the Hawaiian Islands is alive with legends, reflected in the place names, kept alive by storytellers. Moses Goods teaches theater at Windward Community College, and for his current show, he worked with stories that were in the air all around him. He's the director of Tales of Ko'olaupoku, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Moses.
Aloha, good morning.
The whole idea of stories connected to a region is very much a part of Hawaiian culture, isn't
mm-hmm,
it?
Absolutely.
Wherever you are, it seems like there's a legend ready to jump out at you.
There are stories all around us and stories we don't know about that go back hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And probably a lot of stories that have been lost, sadly.
Absolutely, yeah, sadly.
So how do you find the ones that are still there to be found?
There have been a lot of stories that have been written down. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of stories that are still told through hula. Luckily, I'm a part of a halau that's located in the Ko'olaupoku area.
Uh-huh.
So we have access to stories that way as well.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That in fact, that's probably one of the last really a repository of that whole whole oral tradition in hula, right?
Hula is our oldest traditional form of storytelling that still exists. I mean, we've been telling stories for centuries and centuries, but as far as the oral storytelling traditions, we don't really have a lot of that left, but we do have hula.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, you know, because of the way an oral tradition works, mm-hmm. stories tend to change over time, right?
Yeah, it can, absolutely. Yeah, and you have the same story that is told into different ahupua'a, and they might have a different way of being told in those different areas.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which adds to the richness of the environment, but it creates a challenge for the when you're creating a show like this. Yeah?
Absolutely. I'm told that when you hear a story from our kupuna, it is never wrong, even though two stories may be told completely different. Both stories are absolutely right. So which one do I choose?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you have to really accept that whole sort of type of consciousness to mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. do this, don't mm-hmm. you?
Yeah. It makes it more rich. When I tell a story that may have two different versions of the same story, I try to be true to one particular one. Once in a while, I will add elements of another one, but I try to keep it to whatever storyteller it comes from, just one single storyteller, not mixed too often.
Just in the interest of having it make sense,
yeah,
I would think,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what are the stories that you picked, and what was it about them?
Well, okay, there are 11 ahupua'a in Ko'olaupoko. It goes from Waimanalo all the way to Kualoa. So that's a lot of ahupua'a, and that's a lot of stories to choose from, and I have an hour to do it. So
yeah, sure.
I researched as much as I could. I wrote down the ones that really jumped out at me. Also being that I'm a member of a halau, we have our own traditions of what we think are important. So those, of course, came to the forefront for me as well.
Sure.
I narrowed it down to a few stories, but I wanted to make sure that I at least mentioned one story from each of those ahupua'a within the show, whether it be in some of the songs that I wrote for the show or mm-hmm. actually in the stories itself. But I narrowed it down to one main story that kind of is told throughout the entire play. There's, I guess, a secondary story that comes in the middle, and two secondary stories within the show.
But you have one sort of arc to connect everything in the show.
Well, the connecting arc are these three modern-day youths. Local youths, which happened to be the three actors playing those roles. I didn't realize they're actually from that area. They were born and raised in the Ko'olaupoko uh-huh. area, which makes it even
perfect.
Nicer.
Yeah.
But those characters are the arc of the story, and within that, they're telling the stories of the district.
So it really kind of falls together in a very natural way.
Yeah.
I mean, that sort of makes it all come together, but. The two brothers, there's a kind of a conflict with two brothers as a key to the story?
So one of the main stories is the story of Kaulu, and Kaulu is the son of Ku and Hina. He's the youngest of three brothers, and he has the most mana. He's the most powerful of the three brothers. But mm-hmm. when he's born, he is very weak, so he needs to have the oldest brother protect him from the second brother, who knows of his mana and is very jealous of his mana. So that's kind of the story of those three brothers. And that's the kind of the main story in the play, because that's, I guess, each moku or each district on the island has kind of like a central story, like their most well-known story. And the story of Kaulu is the story of the moku or the district of Ko'olaupoko. So that's kind of the main featured story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story of the three brothers.
He's very powerful spiritually, but he's weak. He's weak physically.
He's born very weak, and he needs time to grow into his full mana.
Oh, I see.
And so he calls to his brother when he's still inside of his mother Hina. He calls to his brother Kaeha to protect him so that he can reach his full power, protect him from his other brother Kamano. Yeah.
Is there is this sort of going in a direction of a message about people needing one another, having if you're weak in one area, having someone else to shore up your weakness, that kind of thing?
I think within the stories that our kupuna left us, there are all of those lessons. There's so many lessons out like that, and lessons that we don't consider. So certainly, yeah, there is. You know, there's Within our stories, we have the basic Hawaiian values, right? Ahonui, which is patience, lokahi, which is togetherness, and all of that is important to each and every one of our stories. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, yes, that is in this story.
But it sounds as if it's not a heavy-handed moral of the story kind of presentation either, that the conclusions are there for you to draw. Yeah?
Absolutely, yeah.
Which in a way is probably a more effective way of getting a message with a capital M across. Yeah,
yeah. I try never to be too heavy-handed in the stories that I tell.
Yeah.
There certainly are messages in there, but you don't want to beat anybody over the head with these things. You want to make it, especially a story that's geared for families and young ones. You want to have it be a fun and likable element to the story, but still have these messages in there, right?
Audiences appreciate it when you respect their intelligence, don't they?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Moses, thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Moses Goods is the director and author of Tales of Ko'olapoku at the Windward Community College Pauliku Theater. It runs for one more weekend, and you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
The purloined Panamanian pension papers of profligate plutocrats. Oh, you would love this retirement gig. It's just a tiny piece of the more than 11 million documents that show how the rich and powerful stay the rich and stay out of reach. Pirates of the Caribbean. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Station members make the connection between using this service and helping to pay for it. One way to demonstrate your loyalty is through continuous monthly giving. And mahalo to sustaining members Jean and Shirley Parola of Honolulu, Ronald Schaefer of Waipahu, and Claire Chow of Honolulu. As more listeners become sustainers, we can all look forward to fewer programming interruptions for fundraising. To become a sustaining member at the $10 a month level, call us at 955-8821 during business hours or go online to hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. A highly amended bill would let an agricultural giant continue to divert water to central Maui, and that has East Maui taro farmers saying it's at their expense. So is this bill destined for conference committee later this month? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
This is a long-standing battle and one that reaches far back into history beyond just the most recent legislative sessions, doesn't it?
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, you're really going back to the 19th century and the origins of the sugar plantations. Alexander and Baldwin, longtime big player on Maui. And then, of course, those taro farmers, many of them native Hawaiians in East Maui, complaining still about the diversion of water to central Maui, which, of course, is where the sugar plantation is, the one that's closing. But A&B says they need to focus on diversified ag, that they have 36,000 acres that needs water. They've also got to supply water to upcountry residents, about 36,000 people there. So as of now, the Senate Ways and Means is giving them a three-year extension of their lease to the water rights through the land board. But there's a lot of folks still very, very upset about this, seeming to favor. Their criticism is that it's really favoring A and B over native Hawaiians and small farmers.
And that comes right out of even some of the amendments that were made to HB 2501, that it hasn't really done a job of fair sharing for everyone.
Well, Gil Riviere, the state senator, said, look, all this bill really does is maintain the status quo. It's buying A and B some more time. It's not really addressing the underlying issue about diverting this water. Kalani English, another senator who's actually his district includes Hana, East Maui, obviously, upcountry, and into other parts of Maui. And he says maybe we're on a middle path towards resolving the situation. That said, he actually voted against the bill, expressing his concerns as a native Hawaiian that the area has long suffered, particularly East Maui, has long suffered injustice. He's hoping there will be some sort of a conclusion. And that's why Jill Takuda, the Ways and Means Chair, said this is going to go to conference committee.
Right.
And as you know, that's the period at the end of April, 2 weeks, where the House and Senate are trying to hammer out their differences behind closed doors, right? There's no testimony taken. They're all trying to work this stuff out. This bill originated in the House. It was introduced by Maui lawmakers, Ryan Yamani as well from Oahu. But Joe Suki very much wanting something to be done here. So almost certainly they're going to have to agree to disagree and come up with some sort of compromise, or the bill's dead.
One of the two. And obviously we're going to have to wait and find out, because at this point, that's the next step.
Exactly. And we could talk about this so much more, but my guess is you and I will have a chance to revisit this sometime later this month.
I think that would be a very good bet. Thanks very much, Chad. We will talk to you again in the morning. Chad Blair joins us daily with a reality check.
Comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook. It's 8:31, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. If you want to be in touch, there are plenty of options. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217. On Facebook, you can find us at Hawaii Conversation. On Twitter, you can find us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR. And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up later, a theatrical look at April, the cruelest month. But first, this news from Deutsche Welle.
The Stop Trump movement mounts a major effort in Wisconsin today, while Democrat Bernie Sanders hopes to run his streak to 6 wins in a row over Hillary Clinton. The U.S. and the Philippines hold war games on the edge of the South China Sea, and Europe sends the first group of refugees back from Greece to Turkey. Those are just some of the stories on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan this week, and he joins us from his Macnut farm on the Big Island, as he does most Tuesdays. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So this is a big day for both Democrats and Republicans in Wisconsin. Which of the two frontrunners has more at stake today, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton?
Oh, Trump for sure. We're in delegate arithmetic here. Ted Cruz and John Kasich are in this to prevent a first ballot coronation, to keep Trump under that, 1237 magic number for delegates. Neither one of them can get there, but if they can keep Trump short of the goal and the vote goes to a second ballot, well, at that point, who knows what can happen. So the polls show Ted Cruz ahead in Wisconsin. If he can get the lion's share of the delegates, it gets that much harder for Donald Trump. And this all comes among the renewed threats by Trump of a third-party run if he's denied the nomination. Hillary Clinton's in a much better place. The polls put Bernie Sanders ahead in Wisconsin, and yes, a win is a win, but given her lead, about 230 delegates, I think, Sanders is just running out of time. He doesn't just need a win. He needs a big win. Wisconsin favors him. It's one of the less diverse states. It's an open primary, so independents can vote, but he cannot afford a close victory. And while nobody embraces, nobody wants to embrace a loss, Hillary Clinton can afford one if she keeps it close.
So what about those 10 super delegates of the 86 that are up today? Could they be game changers too?
Well, they can, but as Bernie Sanders has consistently pointed out, super delegates can change their minds. They're not really at stake today. Those are people who could elect to go with the people's vote, whoever Wisconsin votes for, or whoever their congressional. The fact is, these are unpledged delegates The pledge delegates are what we're talking about. 8 years ago, remember, it was the superdelegates who put Barack Obama over the top against Hillary Clinton, so that's not exactly unprecedented, but at this point, Hillary Clinton's on track to win the nomination with just pledge delegates, so the superdelegates aren't going to amount to anything.
As Bernie Sanders' campaign continues, and he continues this drive, it seems to be more, you know, in some cases, as much a moral victory as some of the ones that have actually happened. As that continues, how much does that erode Hillary Clinton's campaign?
Well, some of the attacks he's made against her on the speeches and the refusal to release the transcripts, those have been telling on her relations with, obviously Wall Street. He has exposed her as not the greatest candidate in the world. She's admitted that. She's not a truly talented politician, as she said, like Barack Obama or her husband were natural politicians. This makes it difficult for her, but, you know, compared to the chaos that's going on in the Republican Party, she looks to be, at least according to, you can't put a lot of faith in, general election projections at this point in the race. But at this point, should she get the nomination, she looks to be well set against either Donald Trump or against Ted Cruz.
You mentioned a little earlier about the chaos in the Republican Party, and clearly that Kasich and Ted Cruz are there to be, spoilers for Trump's coronation. How much of a spoiler do you think each is, and do you see John Kasich leaving anytime soon?
No, I don't see John. If he was going to, he would have. I think he's in it for exactly the long game that he has projected. If Donald Trump can be denied a first ballot nomination, then it's open. He hopes that at that point people will look around and say, who's most likely to win in November? Among those three, at least according to these polls, it would be John Kasich. But, he has to get the Republican nomination. And this is a group that has been anti-establishment. John Kasich served in Washington, D.C. for a very long time as an important member of Congress. He's now the governor of Ohio. He is one of the embodiments of inside politics, and that does not look good for him. It might look better for, who knows what's going to happen. And we got a long time between then and now. Ted Cruz is, nobody in the Republican Party likes him. He is, the quintessential outsider in that sense. On the other hand, if it goes to a second ballot, theoretically he'd be best positioned to get the nomination, but this would require an awful lot of establishment Republicans holding their nose to vote for Ted Cruz, knowing that by doing so, they would be provoking Donald Trump into a complete disruptor, possibly a third-party campaign that would make it very difficult for any Republican to win, much less Ted Cruz.
Okay, let's skip on a couple weeks just for the moment and look at another big day that's coming up, the New York primary, just 2 weeks from today. That's the home of Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders was born there. None of them are going to likely let the rest of us forget that, eh?
Yes, we're going to hear a lot about Brooklyn in the next couple of weeks. Sanders is mounting a major effort, and, he has to. New York elected Hillary Clinton to the U.S. Senate twice. It's her adopted hometown. It's a closed primary, registered Democrats only. The polls have her up double digits. 2 weeks, though, of course, is a lifetime in politics. And after a lot of bickering, the two camps have agreed on a televised debate in New York in advance of the primary. I say bickering. In an ordinary year, we'd be talking about how nasty it's getting in the Democratic campaign. But this is, completely, I was going to say a tea party, but that's not the right word. It's very polite compared to the vitriol and childishness in the Republican race. On the demographics, on the Republican side, New York sets up very well for Donald Trump, except the primary does exclude independents. Many fewer evangelicals, many fewer, extreme conservatives for Ted Cruz. John Kasich has yet to prove he can win anywhere except in his home state of Ohio. Trump is well ahead in New York, and not just in New York, but in a raft of big northeastern states coming up, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware. By the way, those states set up pretty well for Hillary Clinton, too. And then on to the, that final big test in California.
Now, I don't want to let you leave without talking to you a little bit about the South China Sea and what we see happening with the EU deal and Greece suspending the flow of migrants, potentially. Let's talk first about the South China Sea. Didn't we just have a situation with President Clinton meeting privately with President Xi Jinping, and that those tensions in the South China Sea were at the top of their agenda?
The South China Sea and probably North Korea, too.
We'll get back to the South China Sea for a second. But North Korea, there was also that round of sanctions from the United Nations Security Council.
Indeed. Reports from the border, though, the New York Times had a great piece from a reporter on the China-North Korea border, and she reported that China has been using loopholes in that Security Council resolution to carry on trade more or less as normal. China is, of course, far and away the most important partner for North Korea. 90% of its trade goes through China. China is its only ally, its strategic protector. But there are hints in just the last couple of days that China may be tightening the economic sanctions on aviation fuel and a couple of other items. The important thing to watch is the progress of the U.S. talks with South Korea on the deployment of an advanced anti-ballistic missile system in South Korea. China has always objected to this because the radar associated with that system can look a very long way into China as well. China has always regarded it as a threat. South Korea never wanted to undermine relations with its most important trading partner, but China has not helped President Park with North Korea. Even more important to her, President Xi Jinping did not take her phone calls for a few weeks after the most recent nuclear and missile test. She was deeply offended, of course, and opened talks on the United States with that anti-ballistic missile system. It's called THAAD. And you could think there was a little hardball at the White House last week. You know, hey, China, if you don't put some teeth into those new sanctions, if you don't act to change North Korea's behavior, well, then, you know, we have to protect our South Korean allies and, of course, the U.S. forces based in South Korea with that new anti-ballistic missile system.
Neil, we're going to have to go here in just a second, but really, really briefly, we just heard this morning in terms of the deal with the EU struck with Turkey that Europe sent the first boatloads of migrants back to Turkey yesterday. We saw that the Syrians from a Turkish refugee camp went to Germany. Today, Greece suspends the deportations. But if the deal resumes, it's not necessarily going to deter those flow of migrants to the Greek islands. Yes?
At least not yet. More migrants arrived on Lesbos yesterday. That's one Greek island than were sent back. These were migrants that were sent back were mostly from Afghanistan and Pakistan. They go into a camp that Turkey has built for deportation. Turkey's going to send them back home to Afghanistan and Pakistan. The camp was built to house 750 people. You've got 50,000 migrants trapped in Greece at the moment. You can see how long this is going to take, and more continue to arrive every day.
Right.
And there's the other way to look at this, of course, through the eyes of human rights groups, that this is cruel and illegal treatment of desperate people who have risked everything for the promise of Europe, you know, not just a better life, not just better economic prospects, but safety, security, the rule of law. The human rights groups regard this as a kind of human trafficking that betrays the foundation of Western civilization.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we got to go. So much to talk about today. We ran a little bit long, but thanks very much for everything. And I know we're going to see you later this week when you come out over our way.
Yeah, a little fundraising.
Yeah, a little thing called the Pledge Drive. Thanks very much. Talk to you later in the week. News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you for the name of a notorious swindler from the 1980s who ran a Ponzi scheme that built local investors out of millions. As all good con men know, it's all about the front and his cars, his downtown office, and a working waterfall in that office, too, plus his alleged NFL affiliation combined to convince his clients that he was the real deal. Now, one of his most effective tricks was adding well-known Kama Aina names to the masthead of his bogus firm called Bishop, Baldwin, Rewald, Dillingham, and Wong. After he was arrested, though, He claimed that his business was really a money laundering front for the CIA, no less, and somehow suckered ABC News into running a two-part story backing his claim. Everything got eventually sorted out, and the cheeky malefactor Ron Riewoldt served 10 years in federal prison. It's now 8:49. That's the quiz, and we got a winner.
Beth Ann, we had several winners, but Rick De La Cruz was the first to call us in. This is a pretty popular quiz, and Robert Dunn of Kaimuki and Don from Kahului knew the answer. Don and two friends said they flew into Waikiki, and one of their godfathers had access to one of Ron Riewoldt's Rolls Royces, so they got to go clubbing around town in style. And if you've got a quiz for us, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Hawaii Pacific University, presenting Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, April 8th through the 17th at the Paul and Vailu Theater on the Hawaii Loa campus, hpu.edu/theater.
Women in Theater is a Kauai-based theater troupe that's currently without a home. It's a challenge, but it's not the sort of thing to discourage true show folk. And with that in mind, WIT is presenting a new show geared to the month of April called WIT Happens. It's a collection of short pieces, and Nellie Foster of Women in Theater is on the line to tell us more about it. Good morning, Nellie.
Good morning, Chris.
So you folks are nomads now, is that right?
We are nomads, and we're just kind of making the best of it.
Well, that's kind of what one does, right?
It is.
So
we're having a good time while we're doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And your next show is at Storybook Theater in Hanapepe, yeah?
Yes, we're going over to the west side. We tend to do things more on the east side, and since we're nomads, we thought we would just spread the wealth and do our next performance over at Storybook Theater in Hanapepe.
And what's this next performance going to be, Nellie?
Well, it is a conglomeration of April events. So we're talking about taxes,
okay.
We're talking about foolishness, and we're talking about rain in April and spring.
Fair enough. Does foolishness go with April particularly?
Well, you know, the whole April Fool's thing.
Ah,
April
yes.
April Fool's Day. So, and we're actually, the event is actually on April 15th, which is the last day you can file your income tax.
Oh.
So that kind of worked out nicely.
Don't we know it, right?
So we have some foolish tax pieces. We have some serious tax pieces. We have, it's just really fun. We have an accountant who's actually helping a manic pixie do her taxes.
Uh-huh.
So we think that will be very enlightening to a lot of people. We're also adding some music. Our last event was in February based on love and Valentine's Day,
mm-hmm.
and we added some sing-along to that, and the audience loved it so much, we're going to add that back in for this event, which is things like, you know, April showers and let your smile be your umbrella, those types of things.
Yeah, which I think is probably a good idea, because as you described the manic pixie doing her taxes, many of us who are, you know, more or less calm the rest of the year turn into manic pixies right around.
It's true. Well, Mark Twain actually said that April Fool's Day is the one day of the year where we can reflect on what we actually are the other 364 days.
Fair enough. So it sounds as if there was quite a bit of material for you folks to draw from.
There is. And there's just great little fun stories that you know, it's time, an evening, 90 minutes of material that isn't too serious. It's just a time we can sit back and enjoy things that are not just frivolous, but they can be thought-provoking, but in a fun way as well. Some great pieces by Bailey White. I mean, we love Bailey White's stuff. Shel Silverstein, a little bit of stuff from Shakespeare. Just a really nice compilation of readings and fun things.
Sounds as if you have many authors involved. Original pieces mixed in with the Shakespeare and everybody else?
Absolutely. We have some really nice pieces by some local playwrights. Fran Kalb is one of our newer playwrights on the island, and she actually is on the board of WIT, and she will be presenting a couple of her short monologues that are just delightful. She has a great way of looking at life realistically, but in a fun way as well. So you can kind of get the message without being too serious about it, yeah?
Well, given that you as a theater group need to look at life realistically and find a home, what's involved in that search?
Well, there is, it's just not simple, and we're unique in that we do, obviously we do what would be considered regular theater, but we really like to promote original works by local authors and not so local authors. Every other year we do the Kauai Shorts, which is our 10-minute play festival, and
oh, yeah.
We get 100 plus submissions from all over the world for that, and we select about 18 of those and present them over a weekend. So we like that to be our focus. So if we have our own space, what would really be nice would be to be able to support. You do the original pieces, and then you support your overhead by doing traditional pieces, pretty much. That's the way theater usually has to work, unless you're on Broadway and have big producers, right?
Well, since we're not there yet, we'll keep in touch with you folks' progress as you, make your way across the desert with your nomadic tents, right?
Yes, we are looking for supporters. We are looking for space. There's a lot of empty retail spaces out there that we just need to convince someone that's a good idea to have theater within their retail area to draw people in.
Well, we'll see what happens with that.
That's what we would like to do.
Sounds good, Nellie. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Chris.
You bet.
For your support.
Nellie Foster is part of Women in Theater, which is a Kauai-based theater troupe that will present WIT Happens, a collection of scenes, monologues, and poems to celebrate the month of April, and that's on April 15th.
Hello again, Michael Titterton here. All the phones and equipment are installed and lined up, and Challenge 2016 starts tomorrow morning. The objective, of course, is to raise enough money to keep these radio stations of ours on the air and to have as much fun as we can along the way. Added to which, it's our last opportunity to work together to finish a fun drive as quickly as possible, so let's do it in style. We'll all be here at 6:19 tomorrow morning. We hope you will be too.
Beth Ann, when you were talking with David Tasaka about making a distinction between things you want and things you need, I had a flash of guilt over the guitar I ordered yesterday.
We won't even go into that. I guess you can always justify your needs. And that's his point.
Yeah.
That's exactly his point, that we all get caught up in that. It's not a good, bad situation. You're good if you do, and or bad if you do, and good if you don't. But that we really need to evaluate it, because money long-term is what we're all after in many cases, not necessarily just the quick fix that you won't even remember next Tuesday.
Yeah, it's tricky to talk oneself into thinking long-term, but has to be done.
Except for you and that guitar. Well, that could be long-term. Anyway, that's going to do it for us for this term. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning. It'll be the first day of the Pledge Drive. We're also going to be talking global media ethics with the Carol Burnett lecturer, Stephen Ward.
And there's an ambitious new musical about water at Honolulu Theater for Youth.
You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments anytime you like at 808-792-8217. Or, you can still email too at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Past shows are under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.